Barnhart Glass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. And guess what? It is all about food. We hear so much gloom and doom with the economy and energy resources, and things are difficult, and everybody has less, and there are too many people on the planet, and so on and so on. We don't talk about that here. What we talk about is all the wonderful things that we can do to make this world a better place, and it's all about food. And today, I'm really excited because we're going to be talking about some, I don't want to simple, but maybe they are kind of simple, solutions that can make a difference on this planet. And I want to introduce the author, Jennifer Cockrell King, who is the author of Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution, Food and the City. I think I said that in reverse. Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution. Anyway, the message is important. She's a freelance journalist and food writer whose work has appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times, National Post, and Canadian Geographic, Maclean's, and other major publications. And she blogs about food and her research trips at foodgirl.ca from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I just finished your book, and I really enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
And, you know, we hear so many things about what's going wrong, and I wish more media outlets, more news would focus on these things that real people are doing that make a positive difference on the planet.
Yeah, it's, you know, good news stories rarely get the attention they deserve, but I think there's a lot of enthusiasm about urban agriculture and gardening and food production in cities, so it seems to be getting out there, which is great.
Well, what's crazy is the fact that plants will grow just about anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you have so many stories of that. I live in New York City, and you can see green things popping up from cracks in the concrete. You know, plants want to grow.
You cannot Mother Nature down.
Yeah, really. Yeah. And so, you know, with a little smarts, a little planning, we can all work together and do good things.
Well, and, you know, growing food is not as complicated as we've been led to believe. So there's a lot of marketing spin out there that food needs to be very complicated and it's best left to the experts. And, yes, we definitely need farmers, and we definitely need specialists in some areas of our food system. But, you know, seeds are, they have everything they need to do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, nature has made it really easy for us to actually become gardeners. So we tend to overcomplicate things. And what I like about gardening is it just strips it down. It's just easy. It's about sunshine, water, and seeds.
Okay. I primarily want to talk about all the good news. But before we get to the good news, just a little history, because your book opens up with the history of how we got to where we are today. And I think it's important to touch on. You know, one of the problems certainly is the population. We wouldn't be experiencing the problems we're experiencing today if there weren't 7 billion people on the planet.
Right.
You know, if there were just
a lot of mouths to feed.
Yeah, I mean, if there were just a million, it would be a whole other story. But I don't think that makes things impossible, and we just need to be smart about it. And one of the things that I thought was interesting in your beginning history was all the things that were said decades ago about the problems we were going to have and how we wouldn't be able to feed people. And here we are decades later, and we're not at that doom period.
Right. Yeah, the world has been ending for quite a long time.
It's the beginning, maybe.
Since the beginning of time. Exactly. Since recorded history, it's been the end of the world that's been coming. But, you know, we certainly can be a lot smarter about using the resources that we have. And we're starting to see the consequences of, you know, our diet and eating the wrong types of food. And just the stress that it's putting on the environment and the planet and our own bodies. So,
Absolutely. And so one of the scary things that I find about our food system is that there are very few that really control most of our food supply today.
Yeah, that was a major issue for me. Not only we just have a handful of, you know, global corporations that control not just our food supply, but our pharmaceutical supply. And mm-hmm. I mean, they're all rolled into one company. But, you know, cities, we have this illusion of abundance of food in cities because we can go to the grocery store and they look very well stocked, and they are. But grocery stores don't carry a lot of inventory, and they've become very good at just-in-time restocking of the shelves because that's where they're able to make a profit. But if there was a problem, you know, getting food into the city for whatever reason, any major modern city in North America and Europe has about 3 days worth of food in it, mm-hmm. and then the shelves would start to go bare. So it's a real wake-up call that we've allowed just a few distribution chains to become so tightly controlled, and if there was a problem, we would all be scrambling in about 3 days.
And then the other concern is that not just in the supermarkets, but our stores of emergency grains, we don't seem to have that either like we used to.
No, it's anti-competitive, apparently, to look after our food security. So, because what it does is it allows countries to not have to buy, you know, grains and food at the current market price if you have a reserve amount. So there was a real push to have countries dismantle their grain reserves and some of their food stock reserves. So it's definitely something we've sort of opened ourselves to fragility on many different levels within our food system.
I'm not a religious person, but I learned a biblical story a long time ago about Joseph's dream and how the famine was going.
7 years.
He dreamt of seven fat cows and seven lean cows, and knew they would have years of abundance and then years of famine, and you need to prepare for that. And I guess we never learned through history, but hopefully we have a solution right here, and it's all in this book, Food in the City. So let's talk about urban agriculture. It's hot. It's sexy.
It is. It's like agriculture is sort of the new little black dress right now. It's kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people have, just started to realize the pleasure they can get from growing a bit of food in cities. And I also think we let our cities become these fairly wooden, dead places where we weren't out on the streets anymore. We were, you know, driving around in our cars a lot, and we weren't interacting with our landscape in a very healthy way. And I think people just decided that, you know, if you can plant a garden and soften those sharp lines in the cement of the city, it really improves your quality of life on a, you know, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood scale.
Absolutely. You know, I'm just looking out my window, and I love just to see the seasons go by, and you can only see that from the plant life that's outside.
Right. And what I love about gardens, food gardens on street level is, you know, you see kids walking to school or walking with their friends, and they're picking up on this seasonality. You don't really think about the fact that they're absorbing all this information, but, you know, if they walk by a community garden every day throughout the summer, they'll actually learn about the seasonality of foods, and they'll start to taste, you know, sort of try to get some of the peas or some of the, you know, raspberries or strawberries, and they'll learn that you have to wait till they're perfectly ripe.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was one of the things that I was wondering about when I was reading the book. Now, I'm a vegan, and I love my vegetables. There's no question about that. But there's a big part of the population, especially in North America, where they don't know where their kitchen is, they don't know how to prepare food, and they're not interested in fresh produce.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're missing out.
This is like another piece. So I am all for urban gardening, and I want to see more and more of it, and I want to see more life. But I'm also kind of where, you know, will other people kind of jump on the bandwagon as it becomes more hip? I hope so.
I hope so, too. And, you know, I always refer to tomatoes and basil as sort of your gateway drug to a better diet, frankly. Because if you start to grow food, you'll eat it. I mean, you're not going to wait. If you grow fava beans, you will search through the internet and through recipe books to figure out a recipe to use those fava beans.
Oh, God, I love
them. And it's actually, yeah.
Garlic and oil.
It's a great way to rebalance your diet because you realize it's a lot easier to grow vegetables and to harvest them than to be tracking down a chicken for dinner every day or, you know, other products that are a lot more complicated.
Okay, so people are finding little nooks and crannies. There's a whole variety of different ways that people are growing food that I read about in your book, either in an old parking lot or these vertical farms now in old buildings. It's really quite fascinating. Where does this fit in with, like, what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do? Do we just, like, get started and do it and see what happens?
That's usually the way public policy tends to change, is it reacts to what people in the community are doing. Certain cities already have bylaws that allow urban chickens or urban beekeeping or for you to dig up your front lawn and plant vegetables. And some cities have bylaws against it. But right, you just find that there are usually a few people who push the envelope. And if there's enough public support for it, I mean, that's what elected officials do. They govern, hopefully, according to the will of the people. So it takes a while, and sometimes it's frustrating. But I'm actually finding that city councils across Canada and in the U.S. are really picking up on this energy, and they're actually trying to facilitate this change because they see it as a huge positive. I mean, they're usually worried about garbage budgets and crime patrol and all these things. This is actually a positive, bright spot in their day when they can facilitate a community garden.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I definitely, you know, our schools are so strapped financially, and I love to hear when schools start to incorporate community gardens and classes in learning about food.
Children are natural gardeners. They love the tactile nature of gardening and planting food, and they're quite patient, you know, and they're quite nurturing, and I think that it's just a really good natural fit. So, I mean, it almost seems crazy that we haven't been teaching food and gardening in schools up until now.
So what percentage of food do you think we can grow in an urban environment? And we still, of course, need farmers growing food as well.
Right. Yeah, you're never going to grow wheat fields in the middle of cities. So if you want bread, you know, we still depend on farmers. But, you know, in the Second World War, so in the 1940s, the Victory Gardens movement, so when people were really engaged in home food production and canning and being self-sufficient, they estimate that 40% of the fresh vegetables were grown domestically, you know, in home gardens. So we can do a lot better than we are now. We think urban agriculture is hot now. It was really hot in the 40s.
Yeah, but unfortunately, as you've gone over in the beginning of your book, a lot has changed since the 40s, unfortunately, and some of it has come out of chemicals and technology from those wars. And, you know, I was so fascinated reading in the beginning of your book the history because, you know, I lived through a lot of it, at least the last five decades, and you don't realize it, what's going on when you're in the middle of it. And I was never really interested in history as a kid, but, you know, now I'm kind of fascinated by it. It's like, oh, that's how we got here.
Right.
but yeah, it's amazing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about even in my lifetime, too, you know, my grandmother used to can peaches and pears and apricots. And, you know, it was a real treat to go downstairs at her house into the cellar and this rainbow sort of selection of these beautiful fruits. And, you know, we just don't do that anymore. We shop twice a week because, you know, the fridge goes bare in every couple of days. Mm-hmm. And we're not very much in tune with planning ahead year to year, even week to week, right? So,
yeah. I think urban gardening, urban agriculture can really solve so many problems, and not just food security related issues, although that's certainly obviously a big piece. But you know, so many people today are not fulfilled. They're depressed. They don't. Mm-hmm. They're not happy with their lives. And we live with so much abundance, and things are so convenient and so easy. And people just eat because they're bored or whatever. And I really think, well, you know, you quoted, I think, Voltaire in the beginning of the book, and I remember I performed in the musical Candide a few times, which is based on his book, and my favorite piece, the Leonard Bernstein piece, Make Our Garden Grow, beautiful song, but the words are so meaningful to me, and it's so important to work and to see the accomplishment, the food that grows up to nurture your body for yourself and your family. And I think a lot of people are really missing that, and it creates an emptiness in them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, everything is so convenient, and there's nothing wrong with convenience, but you're right. We've lost that personal satisfaction of being self-sufficient and about seeing a project through. And, you know, just in terms of our health, you mentioned depression. Well, we're not getting enough exercise. We're not outside enough. And there's a direct link between the type of food that we put in our bodies and, you know, our mental state, because it's all connected. So, you know, just when you can have one solution that solves so many different problems, you just want to run screaming through the streets telling people, you know, plant a garden. You can ditch your expensive gym membership. You know, you can probably lose some weight. You can be happier and healthier and maybe get off some of the antidepressants. And it's all about social, building a social scene in your community, too. I was talking to somebody last night, and we were discussing how, you know, we just don't walk up to a stranger and speak to them.
Mm-hmm.
But that happens all the time when you're out puttering in your yard, in your garden. It's just an opportunity to engage with somebody in your neighborhood that you don't know yet, and that's the little icebreaker, and all of a sudden you've made that connection, and you just have a much more safe neighborhood, too. I mean, if you have people out gardening early morning and late at night, criminals don't really like that.
Yeah, I like the way you talked about how drug dealers don't like flowers in gardens or parks, and they'll stay away from that.
It's drug dealer repellent, basically.
Yeah, that's hysterical. It's like it just provides, I don't know, a pretty happy atmosphere, and they just don't feel like that's the place for crime.
Exactly. Well, there's too much activity that's not drug-related. There's too much gardening activity.
Too many eyes.
Yeah.
Right. So you have so many great stories in this book where we read about Paris and London and Los Angeles and Detroit, and they're all very – and Chicago, lots of very different places, and really great stories all along. I think my favorite, though – and you saved it for last, is Cuba.
Right.
And, you know, I would never wish this on anyone, where all of a sudden we are out of food.
Exactly. Yeah, they, they went through peak oil in a very drastic way in the early 90s, and peak oil and no oil actually led to a real food crisis on the island with 11 million people. So it was a very, very serious situation. But they got out of it. They avoided mass starvation, essentially, through urban agriculture, through organic, low-tech, but high skill and heavy use of human labor, food production.
You know, every culture has good things and bad things. And, like last week, I was talking to this woman who's talking about how the French teach their children how to eat, and
right.
It's so much better than how we raise our kids here in North America, because we're so focused, I think, on empowering kids at like 2 years old to make their own choices that we don't
right.
teach them what the right behavior is. Anyway,
yeah.
There's good things from every culture and not so good things. Mm-hmm. And so I love, not that I want to live in Cuba, although I hear there's some lovely things about it, but we definitely can learn from what they did. We don't have to do everything that they're doing.
Right, right. Yeah, they have a very difficult situation there still. I mean, life is not easy in
mm-hmm.
Cuba, and they have a lot of challenges that, you know, are brought upon them and that they bring upon themselves. But what is nice about Cuba is they've almost got this little cottage industry of bringing people over who are interested in urban agriculture and sustainable technologies. They're also moving quite quickly into solar power, wind power, biogas, and all sorts of alternative energy sources. So they're really making lemonade out of lemons, quite
mm-hmm.
frankly. And
mm-hmm.
They just have figured out how to create a social situation where farmers are extremely well-respected, they're well-paid, and that's definitely something we could learn from.
Yeah, can we underline that? Because you said in your book that farmers were paid more than doctors and lawyers.
In Cuba.
In Cuba.
Yeah.
So, that's crazy. That's great.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a lot. There's not merely the economic disparity that we have in North America, where we have certain segments of the population that get paid a lot more, and, you know, teachers and other very important people like farmers are kind of low on the totem pole of pay. So they have their priorities in that sense kind of better aligned than we do. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot to give farmers more respect. It doesn't cost us any more, but we just tend not to treat our farmers with a lot of respect. And I think that goes a long way towards making us feel better about paying our farmers more as well. Because
yeah.
most farming families in North America, they rely on off-farm income.
It's we really need to change things in this country, and I hope that it doesn't require us to go hungry before we make those changes.
Right.
But
exactly.
We need to get back to the small farmer, and they need to be supported with government assistance to grow the right kinds of food organically.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like the idea that corporations are growing these vast fields of monocrops. There's not even a lot of people involved per acre in those situations. A lot of things are automated. More people can get back to work, taking care of the earth. It's just, it's so obvious to me. Why isn't it obvious?
I know. And, well, it's having a huge effect. I mean, we can talk about colony collapse disorder in bees.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a huge problem in North America and in Europe because of monocrop fields, heavy chemical use where, you know, they dose the crops with pesticides and insecticides, and lo and behold, bees will actually die because they are also insects.
Right. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Life.
And when we have 1 in 3 mouthfuls dependent on bees pollinating our food, we have to really think carefully about some of these choices that we make that give us lots of cheap food, because you know, it might not be peak oil. It might not be something else. We may fall into food crisis because we've killed the bees.
Mm-hmm. Everything's connected.
Oh, we're back to the doomsday scenario
there
again.
There we go. But that's not going to happen because we're going to get no. all of these hot urban farmers coming and saving
that's
the day.
Right.
And we're all a part of that, and we all need to make our gardens grow. So do you have a garden?
I do. I do. I have, I'm not an expert gardener. And certainly when I was writing the book, I was working very hard and my garden never looked worse. So I was a bit of a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to this growing season because
mm-hmm.
I'll finally get some time to spend time in the garden. But yes, I like to grow things that push the limits of, you know, what I should be able to grow.
You're
in my climate.
Right, in Canada. I was really interested to hear about some of the things people are growing up there. So what pushes the limit in your neighborhood?
Well, one of the things, as you move further north, you get extremely long days. So we get 16 to 17 hours of sunlight in a day in July and August.
Mm.
So we have kind of a long growing season in that sense because the plants can really grow a lot longer than, you know, in southern latitudes. We can grow everything. We can get ripe tomatoes in the garden to artichokes. I had some Pinot Grigio grapes growing,
mm-hmm.
And they even survived the winters. Now, I would never get grapes because there was always a late frost that would get the, you know, flowers. But I had grape leaves, and I made dolmades
nice.
All summer long. It was fabulous.
That's good.
So
I'm getting hungry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's quite incredible. And I visited a community garden up in Yellowknife, which is it's near the Arctic Circle, quite frankly. And they get 24 hours of sunlight in the summertime.
Mm.
And the gardens up there are so incredible. It's so astonishing to see what true northern farmers can grow. Everything from quinoa to kale to Brussels sprouts to beautiful turnips and lots of root crops, but beautiful leafy greens.
Wow, that's really inspiring. I'm glad to
yeah.
hear that they can grow quinoa because I heard that that's a very difficult plant to grow on our side
yeah.
of the equator.
Yes, I think it likes extreme latitudes. I think it has something to do with elevation
right.
More than anything. But where there's a will, there's a way. And I think that's why we've always escaped these little doomsday scenarios because we, you know, we're self-destructive to a point, but then we smarten up.
That's right. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. Thank you for your book, Food and the City. It is very inspirational, and I really enjoyed reading it.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and we're going to take a quick break and be back in a moment. Hi there, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And it is April 11th, 2012. I always like to say what day it is, just in case you're wondering. And I want to bring on my next guest, Erica Meyer, who is the Executive Director of Compassion Over Killing since 2005, after having been actively involved as a volunteer since 2000. Since taking the helm, Erica has taken the organization to new heights with continued growth and accomplishment for animals that include ending the egg industry's use of the misleading claim, Animal Care Certified, and successfully working with Boca Foods to stop using eggs. Vegan for nearly 20 years, Erica has been working in the animal protection field since college, and before working at COK, Erica spent several years as an animal control officer in Washington, D.C., where she rescued sick, stray, and homeless animals, as well as enforced anti-cruelty laws. Welcome to It's All About Food, Erica.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad I was able to fit you in right at the right time.
It's an honor to be here.
I like your picture that I have of you. You just have a very lovely smile, and I can see there's a lot of love there.
Aw, that's very sweet. Thank you. That photo is at Poplar Spring Animal Sanctuary here in the D.C. area, and obviously that's a rescued chicken in the photo, and they are a wonderful place to visit rescued farmed animals and to learn more about them and get to know them and see all of their personalities.
Yeah. So just we want to talk about National Veg Week, but just tell me a little bit about compassion over killing and what's been going on other than what I just read in your brief bio.
Yeah, sure. Well, Compassion Over Killing, we are a national nonprofit animal protection organization, and we focus on farmed animal advocacy, which means we expose the day-to-day realities inside factory farms and slaughterhouses and empower people to make kinder and more compassionate food choices. So we do a lot to uncover the hidden cruelties of factory farms with undercover investigations. We have a proactive litigation program working to challenge the way animals are treated and how those products are packaged and marketed to us. And then we have a very active outreach campaign area where we work in different cities, including D.C., where we're headquartered. We have an office in Los Angeles.
Mm.
And we have national outreach campaigns. We air 30-second commercials on MTV stations, Comedy Central, and we've aired this year. We started airing on Hulu.com. And we also have what you talked about briefly is Veg Week's campaign that we're just kicking off this month.
I know one of the things people are really confused about is eggs, when it comes to eggs, and they think that they're buying somewhat cruelty-free eggs when they see free range or something on the package. And well, we know that that's not really true.
Yeah, that is definitely a question that we commonly get. You know, what about eggs, and how do I know how these hens are treated? And it's a It is an issue that I think a lot of consumers are confused by, and rightly so, because there's a lot of confusing information out there, especially on the egg cartons. You know, as you mentioned, we challenged an egg industry logo and claim called Animal Care Certified, and just to make things real, that logo and claim is now gone because it was found to be misleading by the Better Business Bureau. But in general, when people go to the grocery store and they buy a carton of eggs, you know, it's very common to see images on those cartons of eggs or of hens maybe walking around outside or sitting on a nest filled with eggs or some sort of happy imagery. Or you might even find, you know, phrases on there like animal friendly or naturally raised. And a lot of those claims and images can be misleading because the overwhelming majority of eggs in the marketplace today are from hens who are confined in tiny wire-bearing battery cages.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no oversight federally on the use of animal welfare claims on egg cartons. So when people think of the word free range and they see that on an egg carton, it's not actually regulated by the government, unlike it is regulated in the meat and poultry industries. In the egg industry, there's no government oversight verifying what that even means for the birds. So there's a lot of confusing information out there, and consumers deserve to know what's really going on, where their eggs are actually coming from. And we are, as an organization, we are petitioning with a federal rulemaking petition with the Food and Drug Administration, encouraging them to, just like they do in the European Union and in Australia, require egg producers to clearly label how those eggs were produced. So if those eggs are coming from cage 10, it would say it right on the package.
We're not very good at labeling in this country.
Well, I think it's certainly easier to just sell products that, you know, make people feel good than it is to tell the truth. So,
yeah, you know, they're going to fight that.
That Truth in Labeling initiative will hopefully go through, and if enough consumers demand it, I think we'll see it go through. But the basic bottom line about eggs anyway is that, you know, there are so many egg-free options out there that we can choose egg-free foods and still get all the nutrients we need and all the flavors we enjoy. And there are egg replacers out there for baking, and you can make other items without eggs whatsoever. And we have a website, eggindustry.com, where you can learn a lot more of this information about labeling selling on egg cartons and how eggs are really produced in this country, as well as a whole host of egg-free recipes and products to look for that are 100% egg-free, so you don't have to, you know, worry about where, you know, how, you know, what type of cruelties might be behind the eggs you're buying. Just leaving eggs out of our shopping carts is the best thing we can do to protect egg-laying hens.
Right on. Okay, so now let's move to Veg Week 2012. So you have a website, usvegweek.com.
Yes.
And what is Veg Week?
This is such a fun campaign. It actually started a few years ago with the inspiration of one of the Maryland state senators who represents the district in which Compassion Over Killing's office is headquartered, Senator Jamie Raskin. And he in a local newspaper here in Tacoma Park, Maryland, where we're based, he encouraged people in 2009 to help protect the environment by, he suggested maybe going vegetarian for 1 week out of the year. And so we called him up and said we loved his idea and asked him if he would pledge to go vegetarian for a week. So he said he would. He said it, you know, in the newspaper. He was going to keep his word, and he said he'd love to see some type of celebration around it, encouraging other people to sign up. So we went to our mayor. We got a proclamation signed. We got businesses to offer Veg Week specials, and we had a, you know, a website we created and encouraged people in our community to pledge to go veg for a week. And it was so popular that we have expanded it since then. In 2010, we did a Maryland Veg Week, and now it's national. We're asking people nationwide to sign on to Veg Week, and it's a fun way to explore new foods, to try meat-free meals. You pledge to go veg for 1 week, and we'll give you all the information you need to get started. We can send you a starter kit. We'll send you daily emails with recipe ideas and cookbook suggestions and meal tips, and you just learn, you know, different ways to eat, you know, replacing some of the foods you're used to with the vegetarian or vegan versions of those foods. And hopefully you'll feel better, you'll discover new foods you like, and you'll stick with this new diet, or maybe even just, you know, when the week is over, reduce the amount of animal foods you've been eating. And, you know, we're giving away free gifts for people who sign up and pledge, and we have a lot of supporters and sponsors promoting it. So it's really just a fun way to encourage people to try new foods and to highlight how easy it is and how delicious it is to choose vegetarian foods.
Well, the time is definitely ripe, no pun intended, for fresh vegetables and fruits. People aren't as afraid of the word vegetarian anymore, and vegan is certainly used a lot more, fortunately, in the media, and more people
yeah.
are turning to it. And so, that was a nice sound. A lot of people just need a little kick in the butt, and, you know, I'm for anything that works to get people over to the plant side.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right that it is being talked about so much more. I mean, we're seeing, you know, people like Bill Clinton on CNN talking about how his vegan diet changed his life. And Mike Tyson is talking about going vegan. And Ellen DeGeneres has a vegan starter kit on her website. And Oprah Winfrey is talking about it. So this is definitely something that is gaining mainstream attention for sure, and we're partnering with dozens and dozens of restaurants offering Veg Week specials this year, so you can, you know, find restaurants in your communities that are offering Veg Week specials. And it's a fun 7-day challenge. And, you know, when Senator Raskin from Maryland proposed this idea, he had no idea what he was getting into, he said, because after the 7 days was up, he decided to stick with it for 2 weeks, and then he decided to stick with it for a month. And then after the 30 days, he said he couldn't think of any reason to go back to eating meat. He felt so healthy. He said he finally felt good that he was aligning his morals with his menu, and he is still a vegetarian to this day.
Happy story. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's really changed his life, and he has been on board helping us promote this campaign and really grow it, because, you know, he wants people to discover what he discovered and at a minimum just try some new foods that you might realize that you love and want to continue eating.
Well, what I like to say to a lot of people is you don't know how good you can feel. You just don't know because you haven't felt it. And
right,
just
that's true.
Just to just to try it, just to get a taste of not feeling pain or not feeling. It's sometimes it's more what you're not going to feel rather than what you are going to feel, because a lot of stuff goes away and all of a sudden you're free and light and everything's happy.
Yeah, it really can, you know, make a difference. Even just the 7 days for Senator Raskin, for example, he said he felt a difference dramatically within those 7 days. He felt more energetic and, you know, he's a great spokesperson for this effort. And I think that it's 7 days. And as, you know, as he put it, when he, you know, wanted to help us get this campaign off the ground in 2009, he said, you know, there are 52 weeks in a year. Why not make at least one of them meat free? And, you know, it's a great way to help protect the environment. It's a great way to help improve your health. And it's certainly a great way to make a difference for animals. So that's what the 7-Day Veg Pledge is all about. Just take the 7-Day Challenge, see how you feel, and, you know, maybe you'll feel great enough that you'll want to stick with it.
You know, there's a lot of different ones out there. So Mark Bittman has recommended being vegan before 6 p.m.
Right.
We have meatless Mondays. And there have been a number of different pledge-type programs, some for a week, some for 30 days, some for 60 days, whatever. And I like whatever works for people. But I think at least being vegetarian for at least a week. You know, the meatless Mondays and the veg before 6 p.m., they're good. But I think when people really take a moment to think, okay, I'm not going to eat these foods, and I'm going to take some time and really not eat them, then they can really, one, reap the benefits, and two, it helps shift something inside them to know that it is possible and it's not difficult.
Yeah, and there are so many foods out there to try, and I think that is the benefit of pledging to go veg for one full week. You know, it's just a week. It's just 7 days. And, you know, we offer so much information and meal ideas and recipes and restaurant specials to get people going. And just discovering some new foods is, you know, it's very eye-opening to people. And, you know, as they discover new foods that they like and hopefully feel more energetic, they're also recognizing that every time they choose a meat-free meal, they are making a difference for animals. And that's really important for us, you know, as our organization focuses on animal advocacy, is what the animals go through. There are more than 9 billion animals in the U.S. alone who are killed for food every single year. And we can stand up for those animals every time we sit down to eat just by choosing the vegetarian version of our favorite foods. We can have hot dogs and hamburgers and ice cream, and they're all made. You can get all of those as a vegan version made without any animal products at all. You're not giving up any of the flavors you're used to. It's just a cruelty-free version of those foods.
Erica, thank you. I really hope that you have a great week and veg week, April 23rd to 29th. And the website is usvegweek.com. And
yes.
Let's make a lot of people eat veg for a week and more.
Excellent. Thank you. You know, people can visit that website, usvegweek.com. They can sign up and pledge. They might win prizes. They can see all the events going on across the country. They can see who else is participating. We have...
Okay, great. I've got my next guest coming on, so thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. Best of luck with Veg Week 2012. Okay, my next guest is Dr. Alejandro Junger, and he is the creator of the CLEAN program and has a new book out on the CLEAN program, CLEAN, the expanded edition. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Yeah, thank you.
So I get very excited when medical doctors connect the dots between health and nutrition.
Good.
It doesn't happen very often, and so I'm glad you're out there doing what you're doing. So many doctors don't know or don't want to know. Why is that?
I don't know. My experience is there's more and more nowadays, and awareness is growing.
That's good. That's good, because we need medical doctors to inspire and empower people to realize that their health is really their responsibility. Doctors are great and help us out a lot, but it's really up to each of us individually to take our health into our own hands with what we put in our bodies.
Yeah, I think the system has just been a little bit skewed in the direction of testing and medications, and I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I don't think there's anybody sitting in a room planning things to be this way, but you know, things degenerate and attention is placed in specialization and super specialization and then even medical schools forget to teach about nutrition. So, you know, it's a whole host of factors that ended up giving us the situation in which we're living today.
So you got your medical training, and then you went to study Eastern medicine in India. Now, is that where you learned?
That's not exactly how it happened. I came to the United States after medical school to do my internship, residency, and fellowship. And the change in lifestyle, and especially in diet, got me so sick that by the end of my training, I was left with irritable bowel syndrome, severe allergies, and severe depression. I went to visit three of my colleagues, a gastroenterologist, an allergist, and a psychiatrist, and I was left with 7 prescription medications, and it didn't make sense to me. I was so shocked by the fact that the only solution that was given to me was to take 7 pills in order to function, that I just quit the system and went to a monastery in India more to learn meditation. And my ticket to go there was to work and offer my services as a doctor. And it ended up that I ended up running a clinic that included doctors from all kinds of modalities, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, chiropractors, massage therapists, you name it. And we would see patients as a group, and everybody, everybody gave their opinion of what was going on and offered their best solution. Sometimes we'd combine them or we'd choose one over the other according to the individual situation. So that was my way of studying Eastern medicine. It was more a practical approach.
Okay, so you have a clean program, and you have several books and a recently revised clean, the expanded edition. Can you describe in a nutshell what the foundation is?
You are asking to describe the book?
Yeah, well, the program.
The program is a 21-day program in which you do things and you eat in a certain way in order to enhance and support the detoxification processes that the body is already doing by itself.
I don't think people realize how well the body can detox and clear out things that don't belong in the body.
The body can do that really well if it finds itself in the appropriate conditions.
Right.
The way that we live today, the things that we eat, the frequency with which we eat, the quantity that we eat, the combination of foods that we're putting in our bodies, and the lack of nutrients on the other side, not only because it doesn't come in our foods anymore, but our guts are destroyed and we are not able to absorb them. Then that puts the body in a situation in which now the cleansing and detoxification systems don't work that well.
So people can go through this 21-day program and then start on a new dietary program, I imagine, because
People can do whatever they want, but what happens is when they do a cleansing and detoxification program, and such as the clean program or any cleansing and detox program that is well designed and nutritionally supported, then they feel a certain way, and when they feel that way, they don't want to go back to what they were doing before. So usually, people that finish the program, they search for a way to maintain the benefits, and that certainly excludes going back to what they were doing before in most cases.
Are there, like, the worst foods we can put in our body and the best foods we can put in our body?
Yeah, the best foods are the foods that nature designed us to eat. You know, we are animals just like the rest of the animals in the planet. And when you look at the animals in the planet that are living according to the way that nature designed us, designed them to, they don't get sick. We are the only ones, we and the animals that live around us, are the ones that are living in a way that is so different to what nature designed it to be. So, you know, that is bad for the body. And it's not only a matter of what you eat, but it's a matter of how much you eat, how often you eat, how, you know, how long you wait between the last meal of one day and the next meal of the next day. I don't think that nature designed any animal to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's just a social agreement that we have.
Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of celebrities that are interested in your program. And that is a very positive thing because we like to do what the beautiful people are doing. But it's probably because they realize that this is something that can keep them looking and feeling good.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so the book is, the most recent one is Clean, Expanded Edition.
That's the only book that I wrote.
Excuse me?
That's the only book that I wrote.
Oh, okay. I thought I read something here, but okay, Clean, Expanded Edition. And you have a website at
cleanprogram.com.
Cleanprogram.com. And anything else you'd like to share with us about this lovely thing you have provided
for?
Yeah,
we have a system, and we also have a community of 40 plus thousand people around the world that log in for free and can become members of our web community. And people post their experiences, ask questions.
That's really important.
Inspire each other. Really, really nice.
It's and like that's at cleanprogram.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, community. We all need community to help us get over and get to a better place.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food and for creating this program. We need more doctors like you.
You are very welcome.
Okay, have a great day and a delicious
bye-bye.
Time. Okay, that was Dr. Junger of thecleanprogram.com. Oh, goodness. So, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And don't forget my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, where all of those healthy, delicious recipes can be found to help you along the way. Have a very delicious week.
Bye.